There's a story that I include in the book I wrote about Swamiji that I want to tell you about here. It was a small story, this one. A man came to Swami who was very intent about the ecological problems on the planet. And he presented to Swamiji a long list. Swami Kriyananda, who's the founder of Ananda, for those of you who don't know, presented to him a long list of ecological disasters that had already happened or were about to happen. And what he intently wanted was to persuade Swamiji to put his own spiritual authority and the resources and the energy of Ananda behind the cause of ecological rescue. And Swamiji listened attentively and with concern to what he was saying. But then his answer was sort of surprising. He said, look, he said, if everybody in the world lived the way Ananda does, we wouldn't have any of these problems. Now, on one hand, that is partly because, well, we're mostly vegetarians, we're not as into consuming as some people are, but goodness, we travel all around the world, we drive cars like most people, we build houses, we heat those houses, and we don't live like St. Francis in the caves. So it's not really on the level of the ecological footprint that Swamiji was answering that question. He was speaking of it from a much more subtle level. I was reading in the paper just this morning, my sister and her family live in Southern California, so every time they tell us that Los Angeles is going to go up in flames this summer, I'm always looking really intently at the map to see, you know, what part of it's going to burn and whether she's going to end up living with us. And, you know, as part of the story about how dry and flammable that whole part of the state is, they were talking about the Himalayan ice caps, which are about to go away. And I saw a few weeks ago, there was some man who went up to check the snowpack, and you see him standing in this field. And basically, most years he goes up there and he's checking a snowpack, and this year he's just standing in a field that doesn't, there's no snow to be seen anywhere. Everywhere you turn, you see that these enormous shifts are taking place on this planet. And it can be quantified and traced back to a certain, you know, a potential of human action. And then the natural thought is, well, let's try to, you know, get people to be different. Let's recycle more. Let's not use as much packaging. You know, I carry my green Whole Foods bag everywhere, and I feel really good stuffing all the Trader Joe things in it and carrying it here and there, you know. And they're just, I mean, I looked at that bag, and I thought, this is the most brilliant piece of marketing. It's a perfect bag. It says their name huge, and you go into every store in the area carrying that bag. But but it's a good thing, and I feel very righteous, you know, not having all those plastic and paper bags. But Swamiji's answer also is, Master wrote an article some decades ago, and it was a very interesting article, just a few paragraphs. I'm not going to be able to actually give you the relationships as accurately as he did, but you'll get the, so I'm with apologies to Master, I'm going to give you the sense of what he said. He spoke about the famine, this was like in the 40s, or the 50s, the 40s probably, the famine in Ethiopia being caused by the suffering of the civil war in Spain, which in also caused an influenza epidemic in Europe that caused difficult weather patterns over the United States, which resulted in influenza in Texas. I mean, again, I'm making up all of those things, but he spoke of almost all of those different qualities, events, as all being related one to the other. And it was all related not just to how much gasoline we were using or anything like that. It was all about the dissonant thoughts of mankind projecting out and literally interrupting the magnetism of the planet so that everything begins to move in the wrong direction. Now, when Swamiji was speaking to that young man about ecological problems, what he was really talking about is whether we live in this world with the thought that we are in charge, we, the ego, is in charge, or whether we live in this world in harmony with a full awareness that we are children, we are pilgrims traversing this land which doesn't belong to us. And I don't just mean Earth doesn't belong to us. I mean the whole material plane. It's not a manifestation of human consciousness. Our appearance on this scene in human bodies, living out this physical existence, is the last piece of a very long chain that begins way before we ever take this body. The consciousness that causes us to live as we do here starts in the astral world, starts in the causal world, starts with the divine force manifesting this whole creation. And the error that we're making, the last error we're making, is not to put our food scraps into compost. I mean, that's so far down the food chain that it's not a causative energy. What's causing all the difficulties in the world is the lack of inner attunement with the divine force. And even in a sort of peculiar way, this strong emphasis on human beings have got to get it together or else the Himalayan ice cap is going to melt is in a strange, like slightly misguided way, part of the problem. Because the problem is our lack of inner attunement. And even nature itself is not the reality. It's divine mother behind it. When that film came out many years ago that was about St. Francis, Brother, Sun, Sister, Moon. I know many people really love that movie. Many people at Ananda really love that movie. Swami hated that movie. And it became a sort of a, hated is too strong a word, let's just say loathed it, maybe, which is less personal. But everything about it, he found just completely wrong, including just sort of the pictures that they had of St. Francis just sort of frolicking in the sunflower fields and always just sort of being kind of vaguely unaware of what was really going on around him, as if he were just slightly stoned or inebriated. And even worse, giving the impression that what St. Francis worshipped was nature. Because nature is just a physical manifestation. What St. Francis worshipped was God. What St. Francis loved was the divine presence that he communed with inwardly, and then with those divinely awakened eyes, with that divinely attuned heart, he looked out, and everywhere he looked, he saw the Divine Mother. He was a spiritual revolutionary, and it is true that Francis's poems of praise to his animation with divine consciousness of brother sun and sister moon and the fire and the water and the air and the birds and the animals, that was a spiritual expansion. But it wasn't because God was the birds or the birds were God. It was because his communion was so deep that he saw in all of creation the infinite. And that's what Swami's talking about. If everyone lived like us, and he didn't mean that in saying like us, you know, if everyone were just more like us, you know, as people can be. Ramakrishna used to say it. I love this little expression. Ramakrishna put it, he says, everybody thinks that their watch is right. You know, this was before you had telephones and atomic clocks and so on like that. But everyone would think that their watch was right. How many times have you actually been in disputes with people about whose watch is right? You know, there's this great sort of sense of, because I'm doing it, it must be the most important thing. But what Swamiji was saying, if they lived like us, which is this understanding that the human ego and human life is an instrument of divine consciousness, and that it's our responsibility to tune in to what that divine flow is trying to do. And it isn't really a question of all of us just getting together and deciding what that divine flow ought to do. You know, it's a very interesting time that we live in, because it seems self-evident that the whole place is falling apart. And there are all these extraordinary predictions about how nothing is going to remain the same. Of course, just a little bit of understanding of history tells you that it hasn't always been like this either. That there are these enormous shifts of populations and civilizations and cultures and the way the world looks. And, you know, there used to be the big dinosaurs here, and then there was the ice ages, and There's cities buried under the ocean, and there's evidence of tropical life in places that are now covered with ice. So lots of big things have happened before in forces that are so much beyond what the one little human mind can comprehend or control in any way at all. You know, the thought just slipped right out of my head. I'll drink water while I look for it. Oh, I know what I was going to say. I was talking to someone yesterday about agnosticism, atheism, believing in God, being spiritual. And when Master first came to this country, the first publication that he wrote, he didn't actually write the words himself because he wasn't that confident with his English, but the ideas were his. Oh, dear. Excuse me. He called it the science of religion. And that was what he brought to America. He called it the science of religion, this little pamphlet that he passed out. Swamiji recently rewrote, took the same ideas and wrote another book called God is for Everyone. But this is what Master was trying to say when he came with this. He said, in the West especially, where spiritual teaching has all been institutionalized, people think about it as dogma. People ask me questions like, what do you believe in this church? You know, in this church, what are your beliefs? College students will come, high school students will come doing reports. Every so often I'll be here and I'll see a line of people sitting somewhere. And I'll sort of like, you know, one feels vibrations from this and you think, who are these people? And then it occurs to you it's a college class and they're on a field trip. And they just have a certain sort of attitude sitting in this room, which is not the same as what brings other people into it. And then they'll always know because they'll be taking notes after a little while, trying to understand what we believe here. And then they'll go someplace else and find out what they believe there. And then they'll go to this place and what they believe here. But nobody goes from medical lab to medical lab and says, well, what do you believe here? What do you believe here? You sort of ask, what experiments are you running? What proofs do you have? How does that correlate with everything that's been said before? The scientific approach to things is not just a question of whether it's been published in some reputable journal or anything like that. The scientific approach is to say, we examine and from our experience and our observation, we draw conclusions of what is. And it's constant theory that's constantly being tested and refined. And the more our experience changes, the differently we understand things. And so Master wanted to come to this country and introduce an entirely new concept, which is let's approach religion as science. Let's not ask, what do we believe? What do they believe? Let's find out from our experience what the reality of life actually is. In the higher ages from which the teaching of self-realization has descended and will reascend again, it wasn't a question. There was no such thing as religion. In more elevated times, in the ancient Vedic times or pre-Vedic times, there was just life. There's just life. Because life is the experience of God's creation and being one with that creation and learning from our experience where our happiness comes from. Does our happiness come from seizing on the desires of the ego and grabbing them and separating them as far as we can from the great flow of life? Or does our happiness come from understanding ourselves in relationship to the greater whole and living in harmony, as Master put it, living close to the great ocean instead of trying to raise our wave and hold it way above and separate it and crash it against all the others? That's what's causing the ice caps to melt. Really, the amount of garbage that we're generating is really quite small compared to the amount of dissonance that is being generated in this world by all these intense egos just battling for each other and trying to get more and more for themselves without any thought of the fact that we're all just children of God. During the Depression, Master stood up once in a banquet of very rich people and excoriated people with these words, God does not like it when his rich children try to take too much from his poor children. We're all God's children. We're all in this together. And that's not a call necessarily to social service. In our reading today, we have this dichotomy between Martha and Mary. Martha's the one who's working, working, working. And Swami is very quick to point out, Jesus didn't say that Martha shouldn't work. What he said to Martha is, you shouldn't worry. You shouldn't allow your thoughts to become dissonant. Because as soon as your thoughts become anxious and dissonant, as soon as you feel like I'm the one in charge and it's not going to happen, then it's that dissonance that then sets in motion this vast force that causes famines in Ethiopia and wars in another part of the world and so on like this. Besides, as I was saying at the beginning of this, and this also is part of the tradition of India, the Sanatana Dharma, it's part of every traditional culture. You know, this planet Earth has higher and lower ages. The Bronze Age, the Gold Age, the Silver Age, the Iron Age, these are all stories that traditional peoples tell because they have recorded histories of how things shift. And if the whole planet is going to go from one age to another, do you think that the glaciers are going to sit there? Do you think that the same trees will be there, that the same animals will be there, that the same cultures will be there? And Master tells us that we are in this huge transition from the age of matter called Kali Yuga into Dwapara Yuga. I offer this telling you first that this is science and experience, and now I'm just going to tell you this is what the scriptures say. But nonetheless, a little bit of thoughtful observation and even the study of history, and you see that it's there. This earth is known higher and lower ages. We have all these anomalies we can't understand. You know, we have the pyramids in Egypt that Cecil B. DeMille told us were built by all these poor Jewish people dragging these rocks up there. But there's just no way that those structures could have been created by any of the sort of dense mechanical means that we know. But as we become more and more subtle in our understanding, just think about how medicine has changed. In just very recent memory, Swami Kriyananda had kidney stones. And he came down here for a treatment, and we went with him. And they put him in this bath of warm water, and they bombarded the kidney stones with sound waves. And we all just took that for granted. Ultrasound, he's dissolving the kidney stones. How recently did they have to take a knife and slice someone open and pry him open like this and reach in and get out his kidney stones? That's a very gross way to deal with them compared to just putting him in warm water and bombarding him with sound waves. You see, everything becomes more subtle as we move into higher ages. Arthroscopic surgery is now so common. They send a little camera in there. I think it's so interesting. We have all these kids who've learned how to look at a screen and, you know, do this sort of thing. Like this. And that's now what the surgeons do. The surgeons look at screens and they go like this. You know, the poor surgeons who are used to cutting and looking at their hands are now completely off the charts. I mean, they're not there anymore. Because and that, you know, being looking like this and working is completely different than doing it like this. So you think on one hand, the whole place is going to hell in a handbasket. And on the other hand, all of these forces are working together. And all of the indigenous cultures that have been on this planet with us for a long time are just one after the other just being wiped out. But even the American Indians, for example, which is one of the black spots in the karmic history of this country, for which Master said we haven't yet expiated the bad karma of doing that. He said some of that still has to be, he said, in the next who knows when, but relatively, he said mostly America has extremely good karma. Because we're such a generous, open-hearted, hard-working, enthusiastic people. He said, but we have a little bad karma, primarily for the era of slavery and for the way that we treated the American Indians when we came. And that bad karma still hasn't quite been expiated. But even when we arrived here, the American Indians, their own tradition was that they were a remnant of a very great people. And so that, yes, it's true that we walked in a very way that we should be ashamed of. We mistreated those people. But the other side of it was that karma meets karma. They were at the end of their cycle. The people used to be so numerous, and the people, as they called themselves, had been so numerous and so powerful. And now they were just these little isolated tribes. They remembered the times when all the tribes were unified, and now the tribes were at war with each other. This was a higher age having gone down, like many other cultures like that. So then, the sort of over-aggressive, egoic, destined by God to rule the world white people land, wipe them out. But you know, they had to be wiped out. The missionaries went over to Hawaii and brought smallpox to the poor, happy Polynesians. Whoop, the Polynesians are gone. This is not good karma for us doing it. Us meaning, well, I'm not one of you. I'm from Eastern Europe. But you get the point. Pride of pedigree. Okay. It's completely ridiculous. But you can see how ridiculous all of that is. But it was everybody's destiny. It had to happen. Because something completely different is coming. You know what is coming? One world culture. Because in higher ages, you don't have all these divisions. It's one world. Space and time, distance and time is to a large extent annihilated by technology. Isn't that exactly what we see now? I remember when Swami went, this is just in my little tiny lifetime, when Swami went to be in seclusion in Kashmir in 1977, and I was working on publishing his autobiography, The Path, and I was working on the publication of it, and we needed to be in touch with each other. And I would have to write him letters. Remember letters? I had to write him letters, and I had to put them in the mail, and he had to wait weeks, and sometimes they would arrive, and sometimes they wouldn't, and then his letters would reach me, and then he would be out of sync with my letters. And I mean, it was just a mess. And he was over there, and everything got so confused because of all that. And you wouldn't even dream of it now, because he wouldn't go anywhere without his computer, and where you could have DSL, and Lakshman would go with him and set him all up, and he would type and I would answer, and he would type and I would answer, and if that didn't work, we'd just call each other up. Just bingo, because it's all just... And even though... So a lot of old, strange things are still happening. I remember Thomas Friedman said, until America was bombing in Yugoslavia, he said, no two countries that both had McDonald's had ever been at war with each other. But while American soldiers were dropping bombs on that country for the period of time that we dropped bombs on them, children were on the internet in both countries, in America and there, talking to each other. Children were writing notes, I can hear the bombs. And, you know, the child said, in essence, I wonder if it's my dad. You know, because it's not going to be possible to be against each other in the same way. You see, now that is an extraordinarily positive development, isn't it? But it's all the same movement. It's English is becoming the language all over the planet, and cultures are going away. Everywhere you go, people look the same and eat the same now. Even the bodies are changing because of the diet being the same. It's not all of it good, but we're going to be one unified world. But how can you have all those separate little indigenous cultures and also be one unified world, you see? Now, what is this all about? This is all about who's in charge. This is all about, are we just wanting to live isolated, fearful, by ourselves, trying to run this whole show? Or are we Divine Mother's children? You know, in the hands of a loving, benevolent, wise power, literally in the hands of the masters, you know, it's not even as if we have to go into this some sort of abstract mythological force. We're disciples of a guru. Or if you haven't found your own path, but you're children of this infinite force, and we're here on a mission. And our mission is to live as close as possible in harmony with that. And yes, I think we should live lightly in this world, and we should live in harmony with natural forces, and we should not overconsume, and all of those things. And that's all part of the same story. But the deepest, without even any comparison, is how do we live in our hearts? What vibrations are we putting forth? And too much concern for how are we going to save the planet just becomes the same problem. You see? It's just fear. It's just anxiety. It's just this thought that nobody's in charge. Please understand, God is in charge. We are his children. Nothing happens outside the will of God. The only thing that matters to us is what Martha and Mary are dealing with. Yes, we have to do all that work, But Mary has chosen the good part. And your anxiety, Martha, Jesus says, will not take that away from her. I will not let you take that away from her. Don't let anybody's anxiety, even your own, take away from you the only thing that really matters, which is that inner communion with God. Because once we have that communion, yes, we can go out and we can save the planet. We can take on the cause of the glaciers or whatever it is that you want to take on. It doesn't really matter. The point is to live in harmony. The good part is that harmony with God's presence. And above all, as we're emphasizing today because it's Mother's Day, but the comforting presence of the all-forgiving Mother is Master's way of trying to help us to understand and to experience within ourselves that that's the relationship with God. The relationship with God is the little child on the lap of the mother. Those words that the men were reading before they sang today. You know, I am your little child, mother. And I think it was Joe who was saying, I don't want to have to make full recompense, as those the words of Master that they were reading. I don't want to have to pay back all my karma because you can just forgive me by just taking me onto your lap. And Master says, God likes it when you talk that way. God likes it when you presume on the relationship. When you say, Master, Divine Mother, Babaji, whomever you feel to pray for, I am your own. And don't try to put me off with anything else. You can take care of me. Even the divine law can be transcended by divine love. Why should we be afraid? Why should we ever be afraid? Divine Mother is our very own. We live in the comfort of her arms in all circumstances, even when she punishes us, or causes us to suffer, or gives us challenging tasks that we have to meet. Her loving arms are always around us. That's how to save the world, by saving ourselves from everything but bliss. God bless.